Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hi, welcome to our 81st episode of Write Club.
Wow.
Not far off 100 now. This is the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Heather, and I'm the chair of this week's podcast, and we'll be talking about cozy crime. Or maybe not. You have to wait until later. Today I'm joined by Steph, Linda, Teresa, Nicola and Pat.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Teresa will be reading from a work in progress. Linda will be telling us about words that have been added to the Oxford Dictionary. We'll be talking about our writing lives, and I have interviewed Anne Zaraudi. But first, we're going to listen to Pat, who is going to
name the novel.
I am indeed. This one was published in 1987, a satirical novel set in America and described as the quintessential novel of the 80s by The Guardian, while Amazon describes it as an exhilarating satire of 80s excess that captures the effervescent spirit of New York from one of the greatest writers of modern American prose. Teresa's looking very smug.
No, I've got a guess.
Okay.
Either side of me, Teresa and Nicola have been scribbling furiously.
Mm. 1987.
And I try as I might, I can't see.
I'm hiding mine.
Okay. Second clue. The story first appeared in serialised form in Rolling Stone magazine in 1984. It ran as 27 instalments, and it was the author's first venture into fiction, and cemented his reputation as the foremost chronicler of his age. The book was a major bestseller, and the New York Times praised it, saying it was a big, bitter, funny, craftily plotted book that grabs you by the lapels and won't let go.
It's not what I thought it might be, then.
But criticised its sometimes superficial characters, saying when the book is over, there is an odd aftertaste, not entirely pleasant. And the final clue. The central character is a bond trader and self-appointed master of the universe. He has a fashionable wife, a Park Avenue apartment, and a southern mistress. The novel charts his spectacular fall, which begins the moment he's involved in a hit-and-run accident in the Bronx. His secure, comfortable existence is gradually torn apart by the lawyers, journalists, politicians, the police, and even clergy who become involved, determined to bring him down.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
Yeah, it does.
Sounds good, but I've got the same expression on my face as Heather. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the only thing I can think of was Bright Lights, Big City by Bret Easton Ellis, but I can't remember anything about that.
No.
So,
well, okay. What I wrote down, and I haven't read this book, and I know nothing about it, from the first clue, I thought, is it The Bonfire of the Vanities?
It is indeed.
Oh, I thought of that.
It doesn't count.
And I want to read it.
Yeah. Sounds good, doesn't it?
But is it Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe?
It is.
Yeah.
Well, it's the wolf, obviously.
Yeah. There's literally wolves.
Relative.
Or are they wolves?
No, he only has one O. I have two.
Oh. Poor guy.
I've read it. I remember it.
I want to read it. Yeah.
Do you know, it's funny. I remember reading it and I remember enjoying it. But then when I was, you know, as a possibility, and I started looking at the details, and I thought, I don't remember this.
Well, mate, maybe there's something in that, about it being a bit superficial then. Yeah. You know, but it sounds fantastic, actually. It does sound like something I'd like to read.
Yeah. Well, well done, as always.
Come on, lucky guess.
Thank you very much.
All right, and on to Teresa to read her work in progress.
Okay, so another instalment from the Chronicles of Ranella. At this point, Ranella and Kez are on their epic journey to try to get to the city in the outworld to try to rescue Ranella's sister, Larkin. So this is a little extract from that journey. They had strayed from the Mammoth Trail when they entered the forest. For a while they walked steadily uphill, pushing through brambles and breaking low branches. Kez said this would make them easy to follow, but not doing it would slow them down. After a while they began to see patches of snow on the ground. Ronella trod on it just to see its surface crack under her boots. The trees started to thin out, and eventually they stopped at the edge of the woods. In front of them was a vast slope of brilliant white, so dazzling that they both blinked. Ronella shielded her eyes and tilted her head up the great glassy wall until she saw the pale blue sky cut across by the sharp snowy ridge. "We'll never climb that." "It's tough," Kes said, "but we can do it. Let's go this way." He led her along the edge of the forest until they came to a place where the snow was crushed and trampled in a great swathe. "The mammoth trail," Kes pointed. "It should be a bit easier because the snow's not so smooth here." Instead of starting to climb, Kes crouched down to look closely at the snow. Then he walked further away from Ronella and squatted down again. "What is it?" Ronella asked, following him. Kes hesitated. "Footprints. Human footprints." It took Ronella a moment to understand. "You mean..." "People followed the mammoths out." "Larkin?" "Yes." "How do you know?" "There are three sets of prints. Here," he pointed, "a heavy boot. I'm guessing a big man." Ronella shuddered. The unseen brute who had thrown her off a cliff. She could almost smell him, feel his massive arms around her. Kes didn't seem to notice her reaction. "Here's a smaller boot, but still adult, I'd say." "The one-eyed woman," Ronella murmured. "And this one, the small one. Well, her boots are the same as yours." "How do you know?" "Well," Kes was enjoying showing off his tracking expertise, "they're a bit pointy at the front and the heel is an unusual shape, just like yours. I'd say the same bootmaker as yours." He smiled up at Ronella. "Grandpa Leo makes all our boots." Ronella sat down, heedless of the wet and cold. She hid her face in her hands. Would Grandpa Leo finish the new pair of boots he'd started for Ronella? Or had he thrown them aside in despair? She wondered if he even knew she was gone yet. She imagined him reading her note. She felt Kez's hand on her shoulder. "We're on the trail," he said. "We'll find her. If we're going to rest, you'd better sit somewhere dry." "Shut up!" Ronella shrugged his hand away. "Just leave me alone for a minute, can't you?" Kes moved away and took off his pack. He started taking things out. Ronella blew her nose and wiped her eyes. She took a deep breath. It was no good thinking about Grandpa Leo and Aunt Marta. She had to go on. "Now what are you doing?" she asked, getting to her feet. There was a pile of rope and what looked like string bags beside Kes's pack. "We tie these over our boots." Kes was holding up what looked like a string bag you might fill with oranges. "They'll give us some grip on the snow." He threw two over to Ronella and showed her how to put her foot in and tie it on. "The rope is in case one of us slips. We need to be tied together."
Wow. Wow. I have to ask, what did she blow her nose on?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Her sleeve.
Her sleeve, her handkerchief, whatever.
Oh, yeah, I suppose they would have had hankies, wouldn't they? Not paper ones, though.
No, they don't, you know, they don't live in that throwaway society, so she would have to have some sort of rag about her person. But if you think it's important to say that she took her handkerchief...
just jumped out at me, that was all. In a wonderful piece of action.
I mean, maybe she should just wipe her eyes and then she can do it on a sleeve or whatever, but yeah, okay, that's good to know.
I particularly like the brilliant white dazzling and then they go up and the pale blue sky. That was you could see that in your mind's eye really clearly.
Yes, I thought that was nice. I wondered if the use of three words, great glassy wall, pale blue sky and sharp snowy ridge, was deliberate.
Yeah.
Each word was deliberate, but I wasn't necessarily thinking of three. Is it too many descriptors or?
It's kind of rhythmic.
Okay.
Which is
good or bad? Or?
Well, I don't know. I didn't particularly think it's good to do that because it kind of calls attention to itself.
Yeah, okay. So if it's...
So maybe glassy wall, pale sky and then a sharp snowy ridge or something.
Yeah, if it's overwritten,
like that,
then it's better to take something out.
I noticed several snows. Mm-hmm. Which is a bit difficult because there's not that many words for snow in the English language.
I was just going to say. There is in Iceland.
Norwegian.
Eskimo.
I thought perhaps, when he says the mammoth trail, Kes pointed, it should be a bit easier because the snow, he could say it's not so smooth here. Mm. And then he could look closely at the ground, for example, rather than the snow. But anyway, it's difficult to do that. Mm-hmm. A very small adverb alert with walked steadily. I wanted maybe trudged.
Okay.
Or something that means you don't have to use the adverb.
Right.
Walk steadily, trudge. I'm not sure. Trudge maybe suggests march is more of a...
Well, trudge is maybe slightly heavier than...
yeah. Anyway, it was just, it was just an observation. I thought the body language where Ranella sits down, heedless of the wet and cold, and hides her hand in her face after she said, "Grandpa Leo makes all our boots," and then just sits. You can just see that, can't you?
Right.
Her son, she's suddenly thinking, "Oh my God, that's Larkin." Oh God, you know, and she's sitting down.
Overwhelmed.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the anxiety, I thought that was really showing very well what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she took a deep breath after she'd blown her nose and wiped her eyes again, indirect action, which I thought really told the story well. What looked like string bags, what looked like string bags.
I knew when I was reading
it. As you read it, you would have spotted that. Yeah, you can sort that out. So really nothing much to add to that. I thought it was well-paced, lots of action, lots of movement, emotion, dialogue, images, and as I say, just a few repetitions, but it's hardly material.
Thank you.
I'm impressed with all the clever things you come up with, like the boot prints, the same, and the string bags, you know. Mm-hmm. I think, wow, Teresa sits around and dreams all this up. You're in the kitchen and you pull out a bag of oranges. No! But there are many clever things that you've done throughout this that I would not have thought of, but I think it's wonderful.
Well, my thought process is I wanted to show Kez has tracking skills, because that's going to teach you later. And then I thought about the boots and how would they recognise them. Mm. And then I thought, now I have to go back to the early section and write a scene where Grandpa Leo is starting a new pair of boots.
That's one of the things I've got to do, but
I like it, and I've got ideas about the conversation that goes alongside that boot making moment. So that's a good thing that's going to go back in.
I did say that I wish they could drink water. I get thirsty when I'm reading the climbing and stuff, and I'm thinking,
and that's interesting because there's quite a lot of, I think there's quite a lot of drinking water, but obviously not in this extract.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
there is quite a lot.
Okay.
So maybe I know that you haven't had every chat. But
how thirsty do you feel when you read it? If it's not enough,
tell me. But also, as a narrative,
yeah,
you don't want them to be constantly sitting down having a snack break.
Right,
you know, it's a balance. But,
and another continuity point, I mean, do they actually have oranges in this world?
Yes.
So they would. It would be a bag that you'd keep oranges in.
It is a Mediterranean landscape in a couple of generations in the future is my idea.
I was thinking the juxtaposition of snow and oranges.
Yeah.
But she would recognise a bag that you might keep oranges in from being lower down. Now she's climbed up to the snowy area, which is new to her.
I mean, this is based on a real landscape, and I have been walking in southern Greece when there's snow on the mountains and oranges on the trees, and you know, maybe it isn't fine because just because something exists in real life doesn't make it good in fiction. Sometimes you have to be more, you know, we often say that true life is stranger than fiction, if you know what I mean. It has to be plausible within the story. So I can change that, but it, you know, I can change that.
I don't think it's material. It's just,
Can I just say something about the heels?
Yes.
The boots.
Mm-hmm.
They're a bit pointy at the front, and the heel is an unusual shape, just like yours. And I thought, oh yeah, you get different shaped heels. But then, if you're only looking at the impression of the heel.
Yes, and that's the bit that's differently shaped.
Differently shaped.
When I do the bit, the cobbling bit, then I will say that Grandpa Leo cuts some nicks in the heel, and you know, or whatever.
He has his own style.
Exactly. Or maybe I'll rethink it a bit, but there's going to be something which is distinctive in the footprint, or maybe he carves a big L in the foot or whatever, you know, something like that.
I'm just looking forward to holding the book.
I'm looking forward to that as well. I'd love you to hold it.
That's what I said last time, though. It just reads so.
It certainly does. And
fluently.
I get excited sometimes when I'm reading along and I think, oh my goodness, what are they going to do about that? But I'm enjoying this.
Well, I'm dying to get some feedback from all your grandchildren.
Well, I've sent the 12 chapters now to my grandson, Quinlan, who's 10 years old. And
he's the perfect age.
Yeah, and I'm really eager to hear what he says.
I'd love to hear, and don't even if it's not good news, I need to hear it. Thank you.
Can I just say as well, though, I like they walked steadily because it gave me a very clear picture.
Yeah. okay.
Yeah. Okay. Adverbs aren't always
we're allowed the odd adverb, aren't we?
No, I don't have a problem with that. Okay. As always, very little to say.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Now, Linda is going to tell us about words that have been added to the Oxford Dictionary.
I am. It's so funny. Some of these additions, I just thought of Nicola, because she always shortens things, like you're going to do something tomorrow, or...
Tomorrow's.
And this one is... yeah, and prinks, pre-drinks. This one is appals for apologies. So, but I thought,
that's entering in the dictionary.
I've never heard anyone say that.
And is it spelled with an S or a Z?
A P O L S.
Oh, it should be a Z.
Informal.
Appals.
Appals. I thought maybe I would just ask you before I tell you the meaning, if any of you know what it means for some of these. So, starting with baby moon, which is going in the Oxford University Press dictionary.
Yeah, it's when a couple go on holiday before the birth of their baby.
Right.
It's like a honeymoon, but they have a baby moon. It's sort of last chance to have a couple's holiday. I
just never heard of it before.
I thought about a small moon.
And here's one, BYOD.
Bring your own drinks.
No.
Be your own doctor.
Bring your own device.
Oh, device.
What kind of device are we talking about?
Yeah. What kind of part is he going to?
It says it's the practice of allowing employees of an organization to use their own computers, smartphones, or other devices for work purposes.
Saving money, in other words.
Yeah. I suppose, for the corporation, huh? Dappy. D-A-P-P-Y.
That means silly or stupid.
Yes, you're right.
Well, it's an English word, Linda, that's why.
Dappy is...
I didn't know it.
It's a British word.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly from the South Coast.
So it's regional.
It's a dappy. No. To be dappy means to mean
silly,
like,
disorganized,
silly.
Lacking concentration. How about derp? D-E-R-P.
D-E-R-P. No. Don't know that
derp.
One.
Speech regarded as meaningless or stupid, or to comment on a foolish or stupid action. Derp.
Well, that's why we don't know it.
Right.
No.
And faux hawk, F-A-U-X, hawk.
Hawk, how are you spelling hawk?
H-A-W-K.
So hawk. It's false, a false.
Someone who spots false things.
Homework?
Faux hawk.
Faux hawk.
No, it's a hairstyle in which a section of hair running from the front to the back of the head stands erect.
That's a mohawk.
Intended to resemble a Mohican haircut. In which the sides of the head are shaved.
So it's not the Mohican.
It's a faux hawk.
So instead of shaving,
so it's a faux Mohican.
Is that what people wear? They look like they got a chicken's bum on the back of their head, where it's all flat at the back and it all sticks up. Oh,
that's a quick. I have no idea.
Classic example.
And then we have FIL acronym in capitals. FIL. Do you know what that one is?
Father-in-law.
Yes, it is.
A person's
father-in-law.
Yeah.
And there's also M-I-L-B-I-L-S-I-L.
Yeah, mother-in-law, brother-in-law.
Yeah.
My father used to call his mother-in-law Millie.
Oh, yeah.
That was the name. Her name was Elsie, but he used to call her Millie.
And quite a lot of people refer to the in-laws as the outlaws, don't they?
Right. They do.
That witty original way.
And here's another with an N by it. FOMO. Which
you're missing out.
Well, that one Nicola definitely uses.
I heard it for the first time from Nicola. Fear of missing out.
Yeah. Which is when I'm not here and you make podcasts and I hate it.
Anxiety that an exciting or interesting event may currently be happening elsewhere, often aroused by posts seen on a social media website. Yeah, and you think, why am I not invited? Yeah, right. I like this one a lot. Food baby.
So when you've eaten so much, you've got a tummy like you're pregnant.
That's right.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, a protruding stomach caused by eating a large quantity of food, supposedly resembling that of a woman in the early stages of pregnancy.
Wow.
Here's another end by Gratz. Congratulations,
yeah.
Nicola. Guac.
What was that one?
Guac. Guacamole.
Guac.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And then jorts, J-O-R-T-S. Anybody?
Jorts. No, don't know that one.
Denim shorts.
Ah, yes. Jeans shorts. Yes. Yeah, it's like jeggings and all of those horrible words. Yeah. Yeah. You know.
I can't believe they're going to put this in the Oxford English Dictionary.
They've added them. LDR. You know what that is? Caps. Like an acronym.
Leader.
LDR.
Leader.
No.
Type
anybody?
Of light.
No.
Sounds like a railway company.
A long distance relationship.
Oh,
they're in
my favourite kind.
Yeah.
And this one.
Yeah, I'm in one, but I'm the only one who knows about it. The guy doesn't know.
That's a LDIR, a long distance imaginary relationship.
And how about omnishambles?
Everything's in a mess.
I've heard omnishambles.
Omnishambles, yeah. They used it, was it last year or the year before? It was to do with the government. The government made a complete mess of something.
Everything.
Else before Brexit. And
even before Brexit.
Even before Brexit, And they described it as an omnishambles.
Really? Yeah. Well, it's informal.
All-encompassing.
It's
a total mess.
Yeah. Informal for a situation that has been comprehensively mismanaged, characterized by a string of blunders and miscalculations.
Yeah. I rest my case.
Absolutely.
You probably will all know this one. Phablet. Phablet. Phablet.
Phablet. No, don't know.
Don't, I thought
Faber. No, not Faber. P-H-A-P-H.
P-H-A-B-L-E-T.
No.
A smartphone having a screen which is intermediate in size between that of a typical smartphone and a tablet computer.
So it's cross between a phone and a tablet. Yeah,
phablet.
I get that.
So it's a portmanteau.
It is a portmanteau.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, we're getting
it. Someone's been paying attention.
Listen to the podcast and get educated. That's what we do.
Yeah.
I like this one too. Squee. S-Q-U-E-E. Squee.
Oh, no. I've heard this.
No.
I can't think what it is, but I have heard it. Go on.
It's informal too. Used to express great delight or excitement. You don't say wow or anything anymore. You say squee.
It's like squeal, isn't
squeal,
it?
Squeals with delight.
Squee. Have you got, there's another PH one, which is very, getting common, is fubbing, isn't it?
Fubbing?
Fubbing.
Ooh, that sounds rude.
And that's a portmanteau.
Yeah, I think it's when you're snubbing someone by using your phone.
Oh, really?
So if you're all at dinner and somebody's constantly looking at their phone, they're fubbing you. They're being rude and being
that. That's really nice. I'll try that out on somebody. And this one is, I don't know, these are strange kind of things, I think, for the dictionary. But capitals, T-L, semicolon, D-R. It's an abbreviation. It's very handy.
Say it again.
T
L. It's very easy to say, though. Is it
helping
handy if you can't say it?
D-R.
Go on.
Tilde.
Well, I think you just, it's just, you know, it's like BYOD. You just use the acronym here. TL, but I don't know how would you do that? TL semicolon.
Because it's two clauses separated, isn't it? So
Tilde.
But it's an abbreviation for too long, didn't read. used as a dismissive response to a lengthy online post.
So it's tech speak,
or to introduce a summary of a lengthy post.
However, when people are using that tech speak, do they really know to use a semicolon?
I'm trying to think. The only way you could really do that would be on the phone or on something with a keyboard, because you're not going to say TL semicolon DR. So
yeah, you have to press the key a few times to get it.
Too long didn't
That's
read.
That's why I'm amazed it's going into a dictionary.
I know, me too. And the Oxford University Dictionary as well. Isn't that something? Oxford University Press. The Oxford English Dictionary.
Yeah. Well, it has to have everything in it.
I guess
I think
it does.
Print should go in.
Huh?
I think print should go in.
Print should.
Everyone's using it now.
Pre-dinner drinks.
Pre-dinner drinks. I didn't invent it. I just heard the teens using it. So, yes, it's come into common parlance.
Vom.
Vom.
Vomit.
Yeah.
That's been around for a long time. I think I'm going to vom.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you guys, I don't know. How about space tourism? That should be easy.
Well, yeah, that's people booking on rockets that might or might not be built to take them on into space.
For recreational purposes, right. That's right. I thought those were kind of interesting. I certainly did. Bitcoin.
Twerk. No. I saw twerk.
Twerk. But yeah, I just thought...
Everyone knows what that means now, surely.
I didn't know, but it had a picture of some singer demonstrating it.
Mm.
But I, twerk.
So what's the actual definition?
Do you know what it is? Anybody?
I know what it is. It's where you swing your arms and move your hips.
No, That's flossing.
Flossing?
Twerking's when you salaciously rub your bottom in the groin of the gentleman behind you.
Oh, dear.
So what's your definition?
Dance the popular music in a sexually provocative manner involving thrusting hip movements and a low squatting stance.
Yeah.
If you want to Google new words going into the dictionary in 2019, you'll find a lot of them coming up.
Maybe we could put a link on our Facebook group.
Yes, that would be good. And you know, it says 640 have already from 2019. And we're not even halfway through the year yet.
Is there a list of words that are taken out of the English
dictionary? Would be interesting. You'd have to look for that.
Next time, can you do the ones that are becoming obsolete?
Yes, the ones that are taken out.
And then we can all go, oh, no, I use that every day. They can't take that out of the dictionary.
In fact, what we should do is start a campaign. Bring all the old obsolete words back.
I did read an article at some point last year, I think, about some of the ones that were being dropped.
You did? Were they things that we want?
Yeah.
Right, well, we'll bring that into a future podcast.
We will have a look.
Well, thank you very much for that, Linda.
And now we're going to be talking about our writing lives.
Ooh.
And I've got to say, for the first time in ages, I am actually writing. I think some of my travels have resulted in a story. And one that in particular that I've tried to stick it to 500 words was we were in a bar in America and there's this guy with his head in his hands. So I've written a story about why his head was in his hands.
What
was happening. I just need to check the language with Linda. How about you, Teresa? How's your writing life?
Well, this morning I got an email containing the PDF version or a preview version of the magazine Total Eclipse, which is a magazine of nature and travel writing with poetry and prose and some photographs. And my article that I wrote in the footsteps of Jules Verne is in it. The actual hard copy of the magazine isn't out yet. But when it is, I will let you know on the Facebook group where you can find it.
That's wonderful.
But I did have time quickly just to read some of the poems and browse through.
Yeah.
And there's some really fabulous poetry and there's some great writing. So
what's the name of the
It's called Total Eclipse. It's the first edition. It's brand new. It's a guy who just decided to do this.
Yeah.
So there was no fee or anything for doing it, but, you know, I'm just supporting the publication and going for it. But I'm very, very delighted that he took my piece.
You got a credit.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. That's
exciting.
Yeah.
As you know from the work in progress, I'm keeping on with Runella, going with that. I know where we're going in the next few chapters, so it's just that discipline of sitting down and writing it. But I did when I do it, you know, it there's always something that I hadn't planned and didn't expect. And I write it. And that just came through the process. So,
Stephanie.
Well, I haven't done very much writing at all. I'm not particularly bothered. I kind of proactively said I was going to give myself a bit of a break, a bit of time off. Had a lot going on, lots of travelling and family things and so on. So I'm not too bothered about that. I've managed to read a couple of books just for fun, which is nice, and I'm still tinkering with bits and pieces of Lacking Grace. Things come to me occasionally and I dive back in. A few months ago I submitted to an independent press and the lady that runs it very kindly wrote me back a long, very encouraging letter saying, while she didn't want to handle it because it's not within the genre that she wants to deal with, she suggested somebody that I send it to by name So I sent it to them and they rejected me.
In a nice way.
But it was a very nice rejection. They said they liked it, they thought it flowed well, lots of positive stuff, but it didn't seize them hard enough. So I'm another step closer to my 100 rejections.
That's wonderful.
That's the way to look at it.
That's great.
Well, I've had a crisis of confidence and come out the other side of that. You'll be glad to hear.
Good.
I wrote a pilot for a TV show which I sent off to a few people, and then I've realised that there's some things in it that just totally wouldn't happen, apparently. But I've had another idea since then, and I'm not sure whether to write it as a book or as a feature film screenplay. As you'll have heard in the techie tips I gave for screenwriting, the software makes it very easy and I enjoy using that. I'm not sure what to do about Brianne and her quest. I'm a bit bored with it, to be honest, and I'm not sure whether I should just press on with it regardless or whether I should start on the new story idea. But then if I keep doing that, then I'm just never going to end up with anything finished, am I?
Well, Teresa did that for years.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. I've got two. I couldn't even call them unfinished novels. So I would say two started novels with a handful of chapters. And, you know, I just keep trying different things. But then this Ronella story has just grabbed me and it's carrying
and
me through.
And I think if something's not seizing you and holding you, then
I think it was when I decided it wasn't a sci-fi book anymore, and we're going to talk about that genre soon, aren't we? I think as soon as I realised it was not a sci-fi book, I sort of lost interest in it because I want to write a sci-fi book, but I also feel I'm not ready to write a sci-fi book yet because it all felt a bit too childish once I realised that it was not a sci-fi book anymore. I don't know. It's interesting what goes on.
Yeah, I mean, we are learning by doing.
Yeah,
that's what we're doing, isn't it? And I'm learning all the time as I go on, and I'm regarding writing this book as an apprenticeship, if you like, you know, and I think that's fine. And if you change your mind about something and go somewhere else, and you, nothing's lost because everything you've written is part of the writer you're becoming.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. That's true.
And you might go back to it, you might reuse it, you might not.
Yeah.
But, you know, go with what's exciting you, I would say.
I would suggest that go with what's exciting you.
Yeah.
When the words are coming, go with them. If they're not coming and it's a chore, why would you?
Yeah. There's actually a new course being opened by the Story Grid people. Two new courses, actually. One is called Grounding Your Craft and one's called Up-Leveling Your Craft.
Leveling,
and I'm sort of tempted to go for one of those because it sounds quite intense. You have to write 2,000 words a week.
Yeah. Yeah,
I thought, oh, that'll be put me under it, but I do seem to work better with deadlines. And you know,
and if you've paid for it as well, you want to get the value out of it, and you will do what they ask.
It's actually very affordable. The one of them is $97 a month. It's but it's very good value, and the other one includes a weekly critique by a editor of your choice in your genre. So you actually, you know, that's a bit more expensive. I think it's about $500 a month. For 3 months, I think. That would be really great because you're effectively working with an editor as you write.
But
I have got a great idea. I know the ideas aren't going to stop coming, so I'm not discouraged. But it's just a question of, you know, now do I turn them into a book? Do I turn them into a screenplay? What do I do?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I need to be doing what Nicola's been doing, like travel off to fun places and do so many fun things. And then all these ideas will pop up, right?
I did have them before I went.
Oh,
so in the shower. Two in the shower on consecutive days.
Well, I was interrupted by some travel to a couple of places, and I don't write when I travel unless I've gone off for the purpose of writing. So then I kind of got one of those spells where you say, why am I doing this? Why don't I just read books?
Yeah, I keep thinking
I'm retired, and nobody's ever going to notice this. It's not going to change the world. It's not doing anybody any good. Why am I doing this, you know? I didn't do anything for a while. And then when we come up to deadlines again, I thought, oh, I'd have something. So I start to write a little bit. And then when I was writing my work in progress recently, I kept having more ideas about it and I wanted to continue, but then I haven't.
I'm not very good at writing on the move or when my routine's disrupted. And to be fair, I'm not very good at writing when my routine's not disrupted. I mean, the discipline of actually of doing it. So I get that. And, you know, we've all, you know, been moving around and doing different things. And some of us have had stuff going on in our families and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, give yourself a break.
Right.
You know, you'll just do it when you're ready and you will. Right.
Well, I'm sort of working on my little collection of short stories that are linked by the same setting, but not to each other. They're all sort of centred around this particular village. And you've heard a couple of them so far. In my head, they were just like separate stories. The only sort of unifying idea was the location. But I was wondering whether I should be, not necessarily deliberately linking them, but, you know, possibly by referring to particular characters, or, you know, like waiter at,
yes,
or the guy in the shop. Or
I know what
like
I know what you mean. There could be a side character who appears in
lots of them.
I think that would be nice.
Yeah,
if you could do it.
And the other thing is, in my head, they take place across a period of quite a long period of time. Mm. They're not all
happening now.
Or last year, this year. It's over several years.
I've certainly linked my safeguarding stories.
Yeah.
You know, by mentioning them in other people's stories.
Yes.
And the other thing I was wondering about was the village actually does exist. It's a real village, which I visited once, but I don't really know it.
Right.
Excuse for a holiday.
Research.
And I can't decide whether to fictionalise it. And probably change the name of it, just, you know, create.
So that's the real name that you've used?
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Or do some research to make sure that the setting and the details are true to the actual place. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Depends how badly you want to go away.
Yeah.
I think it was lovely, but I'm not sure.
Personally, I would change the name. And, you know, if you have these stories published and they're immensely successful and people want to know where it is, then they can, you know, but if it happens that people in that village perhaps don't like one of the stories or one of the characters, you can say, oh, it's not that village, I made it up. You know what I mean? It's covering your bases,
really.
Yeah, personally, I would be inclined to change the name, but that's just my
feeling. It only started off like that because, like, one of the stories was inspired by something, you know, that was specific to that place.
You can still have it specific to that place and just
in
do
your
a
mind.
Find and replace.
But also what I was going to say is, if you give this place your own name, you can actually, if you feel the need to change the geography, you can, because it's your place, it's a made up place. So
and the fact that I don't know the geography that well.
So in a village called Far Away, I can see it all in my mind's eye, but it's a combination of three villages.
Yeah.
You know, so bits of it are a village and bits of it...
Must help to visualise, when you're writing a story, it must help to be able to visualise a real place as you're writing.
Yeah. Well, I did with Lacking Grace. There's obviously a lot of it set in Hellingley Mental Hospital, which has now been demolished. But fortunately, there's lots and lots of stuff online about it. And I actually went and spent 3 days in Brighton at... They've got an archive place called The Keep, where I looked at all the old papers, newspaper articles, the reports, you know, the annual reports. So you really do get a feel for the place. Mm-hmm. So I could see the corridors. And I've actually got a map. I've got a copy of it to bring home with me. I've actually got a map.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a book about the railway station because they actually had a railway that ran in and dropped coal off long before my setting. But there is an old railway line there and so on. So I've got the book about the railway. So I think it helps to have those things around you. Maybe a few postcards around you when you're writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even if you call it something else.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It all helps.
The other thing I was going to mention, I don't know, this just started appearing on my Facebook, and I don't know why, and at first I thought maybe somebody had
Your
shared
phone's
it.
Your phone's listening to
you. Yes,
right. You know. Calls for submissions, poetry, fiction,
I'm on that. It's it's a Facebook group, and in fact this Total Eclipse, it came from that. Oh, it came from that, right. I think somebody asking for articles. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for that. We said we were going to talk about cosy crime. And I think this has taught me not to go away on holiday, because when I came back and I found out I was going to do cosy crime, I thought, what a silly title.
Yeah.
And I thought it sounded terribly condescending and twee, and I was really quite put out by it. And I thought, it can't possibly be a genre. And of course it is. I'm still a bit confused and not entirely convinced that I like the term, but... So I found a lot of very, very similar articles that said that basically it's crime without the gory details. Plus the fact articles I found cosy spelt with a Z.
Yes. So a lot of them were American.
Yep.
And, how dare they?
And referred to as cozies with a Z.
Yeah, I came across that.
I've said I don't like the term, but I actually quite like crime books without all the gore. And I do find them actually quite interesting.
So do I.
Yeah.
Right,
I like a read that doesn't tell me, you know, sort of the really horrible details of how somebody's met their end.
Yeah.
I quite like, you know, Agatha Christie, Agatha Raisin books. But A.J. Cronin, when he wrote Dr. Finlay's Casebook, that's one of the ones that's there on the list. Mm. And I thought, most of the ones I read, I thought, I actually quite like these. These are books that I read and these are books that I like.
But the term itself is a little bit condescending, isn't it?
Secluded, almost inescapable settings, such as a country house, an island, or most often a small-knit town. A closed group of characters, suspects, who are all known to the reader and all hinted to have a possible motive. Stereotyped, stylized characters which are often portrayed as bemused and muddled to make the main character stand out as the only true sane person around. Focus on puzzle, plot, particularly solving the murder mystery. Readers work to solve the mystery are often given red herrings to divert from the actual solution. The main character is an amateur detective who is often female.
Mm-hmm.
The motive for killing is usually not personal, but with an economic focus. Violence and sex are downplayed, almost to the point of being somewhat humorous.
Right.
I found quite a bit in Wikipedia, and again, it's the same sort of thing. The detectives in such stories are nearly always amateurs and are frequently women. Village policeman Haymitch Macbeth, featured in a series of novels by M.C. Beaton, is a notable exception. These characters are typically well-educated, intuitive, and hold jobs that bring them in constant contact with other residents of the community. So it goes on to talk.
Yeah. On television, Grantchester springs to mind, where you've got a policeman.
Midsummer Murders.
Oh, Midsummer Murders.
Midsummer Murders is...
Yeah, Father Brown.
But they're not amateurs, are they?
No, but it is cosy.
But it is. It would slot into the thing.
In some of the things, it does talk about, you know, they can be the detectives, but there's usually perhaps a sidekick or a friend who, you know, is the amateur.
Yeah.
Just to make you feel better about enjoying this type of fiction, it says, many cosy mystery readers are intelligent women looking for a fun read that engages the mind as well as provides entertainment, something to look forward to getting back to.
Right. Okay, so we're allowed to like cozy crime.
That's right.
Doesn't mean we're dumbed down.
No. I just wondered as well whether authors who write, you know, possibly that kind of crime novels appreciate being called cozy crime writers.
No, yeah, I mean, I don't know. For me, if you talk about the antithesis, so let's say somebody like Joseph Knox, who's it's urban, it's gritty. It's not necessarily about gore. It's about realism for me. And I think I'm not a massive fan of cosy crime because I do like my fiction a bit grounded in reality, even if it's an extreme reality with the psycho killers and things, which are not every day, thank goodness.
Mm. Yeah, I'm with you, Teresa. Although to watch television on a Sunday night, I love a bit of Grantchester, so it's different. I wouldn't like to read it, but I certainly like to watch it when I'm... want some downtime.
And that's something else that the research that I did, a lot of them have been turned into television dramas because they're probably, as you say, easy
Sunday
to
night.
Watch.
Marketable.
Yes.
Marketable.
Yes.
Yeah. And they can go out.
It was interesting because the thing I read said more and more cosy mystery books are being written as parts of a series and the reader becomes emotionally involved and connected with the reoccurring characters. And I think you very often see that type of thing going on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And you have to sort of engage, don't you, with the invest in the characters there. Because I know you said about them being some being stereotypes, but the central characters, I think, have to be sort of quite authentic and believable and sympathetic. Mm. Yeah.
You know, and I'm guilty of making an instant decision that something sounded twee.
Yeah.
Something like Midsummer Murders is massively popular.
Yeah.
It's exported all over the world. And I know people in the Czech Republic who watch it, and Austria. Yeah. But this is their idea of Britain.
Absolutely.
This is where they're like,
But it can go out pre-Watershed as well.
Yes,
so, you know, it can be put on the afternoon when the granny can sit and watch it while the grandchildren are playing with their Lego and it's not going to offend anybody.
Yeah.
But on that track, one subtle joke in such series is how the main character constantly becomes embroiled in so many high-profile cases, often by accident.
A long-running joke about murder she wrote was how the main character, detective, had to be the actual murder in every case because no matter where she goes, somebody dies. And I think the same Midsummer Murders. Yeah. You don't want to go and live in Midsummer. No.
You say that about Oxford, didn't you, with Morse?
Yes.
Yeah.
Going back to the conventions, apparently most often the crime takes place off stage. Not only does it, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. not involve gore and so on, it usually takes place off stage. Mm. Death's very quick. The victim is usually a character who had terrible vices or who treated others very badly.
Yeah, but we don't care.
So nobody, yeah, nobody cares that they were killed.
Reminds me of my spoof murder mysteries, what I wrote, you know, because they're a bit like that.
Yeah. And sex, if there is any, is always behind closed doors.
Yes, quite right too.
if even mentioned at all. Apparently, lately, they're sort of livening up a little bit. Mm. They're adding more graphic language and, inverted commas, adult situations, it says in my research.
Yeah.
So whether it's because the publishers and editors want it or whether it's the public...
clamouring for more sex.
On a Sunday night.
I think it could be interesting sometimes to just ask authors, you know, do they choose the genre before they write the book? Or, you know, you've just said about your book.
Yeah.
You wanted to write it in, you know, sci-fi. And you found that what you've actually written doesn't fit
action
into
adventure.
That.
Yeah. Not even that action, just adventure. A quest. It's got a bit boring.
And that's quite interesting because... Mm. For me, I don't think the genre necessarily matters. If it's well written and you enjoy it, does it matter if it's got a label?
Well, for publishers, for marketing, that's where they need their label.
We're going to talk about this next week.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to some extent for the readers, because I know what I like, mm-hmm. so I look in that particular field.
That section of the book.
But I just wonder whether, you know, whether writers deliberately think, This is the genre I'm going to write in, but as you say, we're going to talk about it.
I would suggest some do, quite clearly. That's exactly what we asked Anna Zaraldi, isn't it?
Absolutely. So anyway, thank you very much for that. We've now got the interview.
Hello, Anne Zaraldi is our special guest today, and Anne is the author of the Greek detective series of books, including Hermes. And I'll try not to gush, but I've got to admit that you're one of my favourite authors, and Hermes is one of my favourite characters. And I've read everything up to now.
I'm always happy to hear people gush. That's absolutely fine.
Good.
Well, Heather introduced me to your books a year or so ago, I think. And I've only read two, but I thoroughly enjoy them as well.
Oh, good. I'm pleased to hear that. That's good to know.
Tell us a little bit about Anne.
Well, my books, though they are crime books in theory, but they are a bit genre-bending. If you were looking for, you know, crime fiction is a very broad church, isn't it? It's got cozy crime, it's got slasher at the other end, it's got spy thrillers, it's got locked room mysteries and police procedurals. And I think the bottom line is you'd quite struggle to put my books into any of those specific categories. My hero, Hermes Deactorus, his name is very difficult to pronounce, I have to agree. But he has been likened to a Greek Hercule Poirot because he's quite a snappy dresser and he certainly enjoys his food. But he also has some magical qualities, to be honest. He is an incarnation of the Greek god Hermes, and he goes around the Greek islands dispensing justice where justice has not been delivered through the normal channels like the police or the courts. A kind of almost a Jack Reacher character in some ways, but a Jack Reacher with winged sandals.
So what gave you the idea of using the seven deadly sins?
Well, that was something, actually, that when I wrote The Messenger of Athens, which was the first book, to be honest, it was not in my mind to write a series. And I hooked up with my lovely agent, Christopher Little, who was the man who discovered J.K. Rowling. Mm-hmm. And he sold the first book, The Messenger of Athens, to Bloomsbury. And then I waited 3 years to be published after that. Can you believe it? The book, you know, it was just such a long hiatus. But after that, The Messenger of Athens was really well received and it was shortlisted for a couple of awards. And so Bloomsbury asked if I would do, they signed me up for two more. So there were three. And by that time, I was starting to have the idea, well, if I can make this run, that it could be the seven sins because The Messenger of Athens kind of revolves around the sin of lust, if lust is a sin. I'm not sure whether it is or not. And The Taint of Midas, which was the second one, it was about greed, you know, avarice and greed for money.
Yes.
And I kind of took it from there. But then, of course, I ran into problems when I'd written seven books, because actually now I've written eight.
Yes.
So the last book, The Gifts of Poseidon, doesn't actually have a sin. It just is just has a crime. So
yes. Because I know I've read about you and I've spoken to you before, I know that you lived in Greece for a time. So are your settings places in Greece that you know?
Mostly they are, yes. The Messenger of Athens, well, shall I say, first of all, I was a Shirley Valentine, but I left a perfectly good job with Thomas Cook's to run off with a Greek fisherman after a holiday. I mean, it's a holiday romance, and it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it, really, I'm sure. The Messenger of Athens was set in the island that I lived in, which was Symi, near Rhodes, a tiny island. And, of course, when I went to live there and winter came, it was a lot different to how it had been with the sunbeds in Retsina in the summer. Yeah. And I think part of my motivation with The Messenger of Athens was to let people know what Greece is like in the winter, because it can be no picnic. And I wanted people to know that, and about the petty superstitions and how difficult it was, actually. That one was set on Symi. And then The Taint of Midas is loosely based on Rhodes. And Lady of Sorrows was inspired. I went to Skopelos. Mm-hmm. And there was a shrine there, by a roadside shrine with all these skulls in it, which really took my imagination. So the idea for that came from Skopelos. Mm-hmm. And so it went on. So, yes, I would say in the main, most of them are inspired by real locations in Greece.
You don't actually name the actual islands, do you?
I don't, because I think it would be a bit risky, because I'm not always very kind to the Greeks. I write what I see. I love the Greeks and I absolutely adore Greece, but like the British, the Greeks are not perfect. And I do write about their foibles and their, sometimes they're, you know, some of them have got a nasty side, haven't they? Like, again, like people, they're people, they're human beings. So I write about all that. So I think it's probably better to maintain a level of anonymity and not name names.
I love the fact that you touch on the bureaucracy and the kind of almost pettiness of local government and things like that.
Well, I just remember spending a lot of time in queues for various bits of paperwork and Gramatossima and all that stuff. You've got to have this stamp, haven't you? You've got to have that stamp, but this comes from Costas in the next office, and then you need to go and see somebody else downstairs, and everything just seems to take forever, doesn't it?
I think that comes over really well.
It's drawn from, it comes from the heart.
Yes, it makes me smile.
But it does create a very authentic picture of Greece, which I suppose a lot of summer visitors would never realise.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think what I've tried to do really is get under the skin of that veneer, you know, then paint the real Greece, if you like, get to the heart of the real Greece, which I think is quite difficult to do, but it perhaps is easier for a foreigner than it is for a Greek. I just very quick, I did a reading at a bookstore in Athens several years ago, and a Greek journalist read a piece from The Taint of Midas, and it's a piece where the restaurant owner, Palliakis, is serving all this duff food to these British tourists and saying, well, it doesn't matter because the English know nothing about fish. And as this journalist read this passage that I had written, of course, I just wanted the ground to swallow me up. But when he got to the end of it, there was like this silence in the room. And then a woman at the back said, a Greek woman, she said, how can you know us so well? And I thought, well, okay, so they weren't taking offence. I think they were just quite amused that someone from the outside could see them as they are. It's kind of like Bill Bryson writing about the British, isn't it?
Yeah.
He writes brilliantly about the British because he's not British. You see the foibles, don't you, and the peculiarities. But what seems normal to us is not normal to Bill Bryson. In the same way, Greek life is not normal to me. It's endlessly interesting and intriguing.
It's one of my favourite bits was your description of Greek chairs, but the fact that, you know, it was deliberate so that people didn't sit there for too long.
I think it's true, though, that I think I hit on the truth with that.
Yes. So what's going to happen with Hermes now in the future?
Well, book 9 is half written, but I have to say it has been on quite a long pause because I have been working on another project, which is still top secret. but will be revealed in the next couple of months, hopefully.
So you're living in England now. Are you finding that difficult at all to write about?
Yeah, I find it immensely difficult. I would come back to Greece in a heartbeat. My son is still living in Greece. He's in Rhodes at the moment teaching scuba diving. And my other half is, he's a bit of a Greekophile, but he doesn't speak Greek and he's a bit nervous about making the leap and going to live there. We do visit pretty regularly. In fact, we are going to Ithaca next week, which
is lovely.
Very excited about. But I think the time will come in the next couple of years. I think we will be spending a lot more time in Greece because I really miss it in my, you know, I feel I'm Greek in my soul and I really, really miss it. So I think we will be spending a lot more time back there before too long.
But do you find it difficult to write and get the same flavour being so far away, or is it just so much part of you?
Two things. It is more difficult to write here because, I mean, I'm looking at green fields of oilseed rape and a river, you know, a dirty brown river, and, you know, out here in the fens, and it's quite difficult to mentally conjure that beautiful blue sea. So I do definitely write better Hermes when I'm in Greece. So yes, I do find that quite difficult. Having said that, every time we come to Greece, I take masses and masses of photographs and I take masses and masses of notes.
Right.
So I've got about 8 notebooks filled with little drawings of old blokes in cafes and, you know, all kinds of the weird and wonderful things that you see. So I have got plenty of notes to play with, but it's just not quite the same as, you know, sitting there with a view of the sea. It just, you know, when it's much easier to write Hermes when I'm in the right setting.
Did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
Yes, I did. I won a prize for writing when I was 9. I won a platinum pen in an essay competition and had it presented on the school platform. And that was, I think something clicked in me then. I thought, this is what I want to do. And when I was 16, I told my best friend that I wanted to be a writer. And when I was 18, I wrote my first novel. And it was not very good, but it wasn't as bad as it might have been. It could have been a lot worse. And I've just always written since then. And I was quite late in having any kind of success because I was busy having a career and children and things like that. Yeah, I've always written and it's always been in me. And I think now, because I've just had a big birthday, I'm not going to say which one, but it's a bigger one than I wanted, I have to say. I feel I've honed my craft now. I feel I can write a lot faster without having to do quite so much editing and correction, because I'm somebody who polishes and polishes and polishes. The version that you read of the books, I have probably been through easily 20 times. You know, I'm a real, real fanatic about polishing. And I find as I get older, I can put the words together a bit easier now and I don't have to do quite so much polishing. And I think that is just having studied my craft for a lifetime, really, I suppose.
So do you polish as you write or do you write and then go back?
I always write a very, very rough draft first. And I think it's a mistake to try and polish as you go because that interrupts the flow of the story.
Nice.
So my first draft, no one would ever, ever be allowed to read it because it tends to be pretty rubbish, to be honest. But I kind of think of that as being a pencil sketch of the painting. And if you think of it as painting with words, the first outline is like the pencil sketch. And then I go back and polish it and, you know, put in the colours, put in the background. And, you know, it's that kind of a process. But my first drafts are always awful. But it's, you know, it's just getting the right number of words down on the page, really, initially, and having something to work with and shaping it from there.
You said that the writing process gets easier, because I'm always amazed by people who produce series of books. Most of us struggle to produce one.
It's a marathon. I think it's a certain mentality you've got to have. I mean, my sister has always wanted to be a writer, but, you know, she's never even finished a short story. So, you know, it's not going to happen, is it? You've really got to be absolutely determined and very, very disciplined to get the right number of words down on the page. When my son was very young, you know, people say, oh, I don't have time. When my son was very young, I used to set the alarm for 2 o'clock in the morning and get up and write for 2 hours between 2 and 4. And then I still have to get up, you know, to see to him at 6, 6:30. But I was disciplined enough to make the time. But I think that's because, you know, I am, it's in me. I am a writer, and it's kind of like a compulsion to write. And I think if you haven't got that, you're never going to have the stamina to write, you know, book after book after book.
Are you still disciplined in that you have to have set writing times?
Less disciplined than I was, I have to say, because I kind of think, you know, I've spent a lot of time by myself in my study writing, shut away from the world. And I'm kind of at an age now where I want to get out and about a bit. And that discipline takes a year. It takes me a year to write a book.
Right.
And I think, you know, well, life is getting shorter and shorter, and there's places I want to go and people I want to see. So I'm less disciplined than I was. I'm a bit easier on myself, I think. I'm kind of going into semi-retirement, really, but I would never say that in front of my publisher or my agent.
You just have to hope they don't listen.
Yes.
Have you ever thought about going back to one of your early works and rewriting or having another look at it?
Do you know what? Funnily enough, I did do that a couple of years ago. I went through them all. Right. And The Messenger of Athens, I did quite a lot of work on, because it's over 10 years since I wrote that book. There were always bits of it a couple of years down the line. I thought, oh, I don't quite like that. Right. And I have actually redone The Messenger of Athens. It's still the same story, but I did make quite a lot of changes to it. And then as I went on, I think this is what I mean by kind of improving my craft. Mm. The further I went through the series, the less I thought they needed improving and updating and whatever. Mm. But The Messenger of Athens, I thought I could do better than that. So I went through, and I have the version that's available now is the 10th anniversary edition, which has got quite a lot of changes in it compared to the original.
Oh, I shall look out for that one.
Yeah, I know.
Yes. There's a lot more swearing in the original one, actually. When I wrote The Message of Athens originally, I mean, Greek people swear an awful lot, don't they?
Yes.
And I kind of put that into The Messenger of Athens, and there was a lot of swearing in it. And when I read it, you know, a couple of years ago, I thought, oh, this is perhaps a bit too much, really, and I'm going to tone it down a bit. So I've toned that down is one thing I did with it.
Have you been translated into Greek?
Yes, I have. And that was a bit scary. I think the first three books were translated into Greek, which I wasn't very keen on, actually, because I didn't want the Greeks to know what I was saying about them. It's kind of like Donna Leon, you know, Donna Leon, who writes the Venice books, yeah. the Brunetti books. She has always refused to have her books translated into Italian for the same reason.
Right.
But I needed the money at the time, so I took the money and hoped no one would ever pull me up on it. But yeah, the books are, I think, as far as I know, they're still available in Greek, the first three.
One thing I wanted to ask about, looking at Amazon in the sort of the blurb around the novel, one of your sort of reviews from the Daily Telegraph described your books as gloriously sunny escapism, the perfect holiday read. Are you happy with that?
It's not what I would call them, to be honest. I think they're quite dark. You know, Bloomsbury, when they have had several jackets in their lives, but Bloomsbury at one point had put on these really what I thought were quite girly covers, which I thought were highly inappropriate, you know, because they're really not a cozy or a girly read. I don't think they, on the face of it, they seem to be perhaps like Greece itself. It seems, you know, quite sunny on the surface, but I think my books have definitely got a very dark underbelly. So no, I wouldn't say they were sunny escapism, really. In fact, The Doctor of Thessaly, which has got a horrible crime at the end to do with old ladies, no spoilers if nobody's read it yet. Mm-hmm. There is a review on Amazon where a woman said she enjoyed the book in the beginning but was so shocked by the ending that she couldn't possibly recommend it to anybody else, and she gave it 1 star.
Oh dear.
Because the ending was so shocking. But the ending is shocking. But so, no, it's not really, perhaps not really sunbed fodder, is it?
I wouldn't have said so.
But you mentioned their cosy crime, and that's something I must admit, I find the term patronising and awful. Certainly don't think your books fit into that at all. But I think as a genre, it's not very, I don't think it's very nice about people's writing.
cozy crime has got a bad rap, but then perhaps in some ways deserved, because, you know, in America they've got series happening with cats solving crimes and all sorts of things, you know, and there's Agatha Raisin, and I think, you know, there is a market, there's a big market for that stuff. But no, I absolutely agree with you. I don't see myself in that market at all.
You mentioned that you've got a secret project. Is this another Greek, or can you not tell us?
I'm not supposed to tell you, but all I will say is it will be announced on Facebook and on my website in due course. Oh. That's all I'm allowed to say at the moment.
Right. Oh, that sounds exciting. Sounds exciting. Right. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Absolutely. Lovely to talk to you.
And good luck in the future. And I can't wait to see the next project.
Great interview with one of my favourite authors. Sadly, we're almost at the end of our podcast. But first, Nicola and Helen Suddard are going to tell us what's on their bedside table.
Yes, I'm reading A Kilo of String by Rob Johnson.
Oh, Fred.
And I think, because we all talk about the difficult line of writing about being abroad, and we all argue endlessly about whether people get it right or not, I think he's pretty much got it right here. He's talking about the quirks of living in Greece, and he's not, I don't feel he's being particularly patronising while still highlighting some of the quirks. What do you think, Steph?
It's quite an old book now, so it's quite out of date, but in terms of, you know, what's happening in modern day Greece, unless he's updated it. But yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a nice light read. I don't know why I started it. I think the last one I read must have been particularly hard going, so I fancied something a bit light, and I must have heard about it from you, but I am enjoying it. It's very nice.
And A Kilo of String comes from the fact that he went to the hardware store in Greece and he wanted to buy a certain length of string, and they sell it by the kilo, as they do wine and
rope, string, chains for your boats.
Yeah,
all of that's
done by the kilo, which can be quite disconcerting because you know how many metres you want. That doesn't necessarily
mean how
many
much
kilo.
It weighs.
So, but now I have laughed out loud several times, so it's
that's
doing
a good recommendation.
Job.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now we'll listen to what Helen Suddard has got on her bedside table.
Helen Suddard, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I just finished reading Louise Penny, Bury the Dead, which is a part of her Inspector Gamache series. Louise Penny is an author of, I think, English origin, but lives in Montreal, well, near Quebec, actually. And she writes about this Inspector Gamache, who's in the Sûreté. So he's a police officer, and his cases. So it's generally murder mystery, you know, which is my go-to for bedtime. And I think it's quite interesting because you learn quite a bit about the... this particular book tells you quite a bit about the tension between what they call the Anglos, you know, the English people of English origin in Quebec, and particularly in Quebec City. This one is set in Quebec City. And the French-speaking, French people of French origin, and the separatists, so those people who want, you know, Quebec to become an independent state within Canada. This is book six in the series, and I've read all five coming up to book six. I gather, apparently, that there are 16 of them, so I don't know whether I'll get that far. But this one in particular I found very interesting because it covered, you know, something I didn't really know much about. And checking with a Canadian friend who comes from Montreal, you know, I think the facts, and who has also read this book, I think the facts are quite accurate. So I just found it had, for me, you know, the murder mystery aspect, which the detective novel, which is, as I say, my go-to in bed, and also some, you know, it gave me some interesting information about something I don't really know anything about.
Well, that was Write Club, the podcast. Thanks to all of you who take the time to listen to us. Do get in touch and let us know what you are writing or reading. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so that every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club, the podcast. Please leave a review and do tell your friends about us. Bye.
Bye. Bye.